quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
Hello, you're listening to the podcast, So There I Was. This is episode number 97, titled, I Saw the Ship's Propellers.
Okay, Fig, I don't think we've ever gotten a show title in the first 12 seconds of a show.
It was the So There I Was story. And yeah, I'm like,
it was the opening tease. Boom. Okay, in fairness, it's a little more than 12 seconds in, but not much.
No, yeah. Yeah. What a great guest. Mooch. Call sign Mooch, Ward Carroll, F-14, yep. Rio extraordinaire. Holy shit, he's done it all.
If you're not familiar, several hundred thousand listeners and viewers on his YouTube channel, a professional broadcaster to say the least, but a professional naval officer, professional aviator, professional author, professional musician. Dude's just professional.
Yeah, he's an overachiever. That son of a bitch is an overachiever, and he's pretty.
What it
damn
boils
awesome.
Down to, yeah. I mean, he was Grandpa Pettibone.
He was Grandpa Pettibone for 5 years. And I was like, holy shit, I've never met an actual Grandpa Pettibone before. So that just was, okay, I'm still processing that.
Right? Very cool. Amazing stuff. Naval Academy grad, F-14 Rio, right out of flight school, into the rag, right out of the rag, and boom, out on a pump and watching the world go by. And talk about a guy who got a catbird seat for much of his career. And the guy who's been there, done that, got the t-shirt.
Yeah.
That's Mooch. And yep. He was gracious enough to spend several minutes with us, an hour and a half with us. And wow, we hope he comes back. Great storyteller. I want to hear more about his ACM exploits. We heard one.
Yeah. Don't ruin it.
Well, let me put it this way. He couldn't eject.
Oh.
Because yeah.
Yeah.
He said it would have killed him if they'd ejected. So.
Yeah, that was almost a title. Yeah. Midair, almost midair over Morocco. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah. Oof. It was bad.
Also learned about the award of the Brown Star. So we'll just leave that. Leave that for you.
Let your imaginations run wild, folks.
That's coming downrange. It's fun. It goes quick. It like it always does. I wish there was more time.
Right. I will mention, he wrote a trilogy. It's called the Punks Trilogy. So it's Punks War, Punks Wing, and Punks Fight, all available on Amazon. He wrote another book called The Aid. And another book that he encourages listeners not to buy. So, Militia Kill. So, he says he called it a blatant attempt at being commercial. He didn't like it. He's not really proud of that book. But the other books are fascinating reads, I can assure you. Available on Amazon. So, again, Punk's Trilogy. If you look up Ward Carroll and Punk's War, Punk's Wing, or Punk's Fight. Great, great writing. And puts you right in the ready room with the pilots and Rios in the F-14 community in their heyday. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Fun stuff. I don't know, Fig. All I can say is thank you to all our Patreon and direct donors, contributors. God bless you. Cause you're keeping the engines turning, keeping the fuel in our tanks. So we can keep bringing this to you.
Thank you. What do you say? Well, we get out of the way.
Don't sit on the ejection.
No, do it. Don't
about crossing the pond.
Here comes Mooch.
At night, in the world's smallest cockpit, on the tanker, through the weather, and to the tanker crew who did that, thanks a lot, we really appreciated that. I'm just kidding. No, I'm not. Well, there I was. Crossing the pond, and you could see that I wasn't exactly fun.
So in the back of a puking dog F-14B with Grinch Brophy as the pilot in the North Atlantic off the Shetland Islands, the hairiest flying I've ever done, the hairiest flying conditions, Beaufort 12. And we're trying to get aboard, daytime, icing up. As I said, the sea state is very high. And because the deck was pitching so much, the LSOs, the landing signal officer, was using Movilus because the automatic landing system doesn't work when the deck is moving. So the LSOs have to control it manually. So further, the LSO is giving us what they call sugar calls, which are sort of, you got it, fly the ball, deck's down, don't chase it, easy with it, looking good, keep it coming. And so I'm trying to back up Grinch Brophy with airspeeds, but because the wind is so high and the turbulence is so much, the pedostatic gear is getting disturbed. So the airspeed indicator is kind of jumping around and I really can't give them airspeed trends. So I'm just, I have a repeat of the needles on my display and I'm just sort of backing him up with the needles and looking good. And all of a sudden a blast of power and the LSO goes easy with it. And we had a long bolter. And so a bolter is when the hook doesn't catch the wire. So we barely touch the deck and we're airborne again. Gear up, hit the tanker. That's another pain in the butt because the basket's moving all over the place. And I'm convinced we're going to flame out and wind up in the water, which means we're going to die. Although we are wearing exposure suits, you know, in the North Atlantic, the water's so cold that all that does is prolong your agony for a couple of minutes to wear an exposure suit. So I asked Grinch, what happened? And he says, I saw the ship's propellers when the bow went down, and that kind of freaked him out. So we finally got aboard, but that was the hairiest flight ops I've ever been involved with by far.
I saw the ship's propellers. Oh. Whoa. Well, welcome to So There I Was, and that's how you start an aviation story right there. This is Fig. I'm in Kansas City, Missouri, Kearney, Missouri today. Where's my co-host?
Coming to you from Pensacola today, folks.
Hey!
Yeah, that is, cradle. That is how all eight great aviation tales begin, indeed. That is terrifying, Mooch. Thank you so much. So, for those of you that didn't recognize voice, you should have, because you should be subscribed to his YouTube channel. This is none other than Mooch, Ward Carroll. So, thank you very much for taking time out of your day to join us.
No, it's my pleasure to join you guys. Big fan of the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's awesome. So we got to go back to the beginning where we always go. What is it that piqued your interest in aviation back in the early days? And how did you decide that you wanted to get into airplanes?
So my dad was a Marine Corps attack pilot. He flew A-4s in Vietnam. And I lived on base at Cherry Point during high school. He was the CEO of VMA All-Weather 121, the Green Knights.
Nice.
Okay.
Now flying F-35Bs. But at that time, they were flying A-6Es. We're talking mid-70s. And so, you know, naturally, when you see your dad at a fly-in, you know, getting out of an airplane and all of the pageantry and, you know, he has the buddies over to the house on a Friday night and they're in the backyard barbecuing and drinking beer and having a great time, you're like, I kind of want to be part of that. It was both the what I perceived to be the excitement of military aviation, but also maybe even more so the camaraderie of a squadron. Right. And so, you know, as all juniors in high school start to figure out or try to figure out where you're going to go to college, I, you know, had two choices, basically. One was the University of Michigan, and the other was I wanted to go to the Naval Academy. And my desire to go to the Naval Academy was fueled by some of the junior officers in my dad's squadron at the time who were grads. And they had these, again, sort of funny stories of camaraderie and making the best of challenging circumstances. And, you know, that's just kind of why I enjoyed being on sports teams or, you know, why my circle of friends in high school. And I wanted to, you know, to keep that going or take it to the next level. But my high school grades weren't that great and my SAT scores were very average. So I had to go to prep school for a year. Okay. Down in Texas at the Marine Military Academy, which I'm happy I did. At the time, it was a drag because really I was going to an extra year of high school, right? So everybody else is going to UNC Chapel Hill and ECU and sure. Different places like that. And they're like, where are you going? I'm like, I'm going back to high school in Texas. You know, so that allowed me to cut the apron strings and I had like Bjorn Borg long hair and I had to cut it to go to the Marine Military Academy. So it made plebe year a lot easier. than it otherwise would have been, because I was like, hey, it's college. You know, I'd already been to a pretty hard prep school. You know, the Marine Military Academy is down in South Texas in Harlingen.
Right. Harlingen, yeah. Yeah. Hey, Mooch, just by happenstance, what year would it have been that you went to
the Marine? I was there 77, 78.
Okay. I had a Marine Corps buddy that was there also, but he was a couple of years after you. Okay. Rick Forte is his name. He ended up flying A6s as well.
Amazing school. It's actually no longer in the Naval Academy's prep school program, which breaks my heart, but it did everything I needed, you know, and again, plebe summer, I don't want to say it was a joke, but between being raised by the great Santini and doing a year of prep school, you know, getting yelled at by, you know, 21, 22-year-olds, it was like, whatever.
Yeah, that all you got?
Yeah.
I've had Marine gunnery sergeants chew my backside.
Yeah, exactly, right? The instructors at the Marine Military Academy were all retired gunnies and sergeants major with backstories like Chosin Reservoir and stuff like that.
Jeez.
You know, they were amazing guys and tough. And so, you know, I'm glad I did it again. At the time, it seemed like a bummer, but it worked out great. So went to the Naval Academy, very much enjoyed going to school there. And, you know, the challenge was not flunking out. It wasn't really the military side, and identified with being a mid, you know? Okay. And so when you are a senior, a firstie, it's time to pick a warfare specialty. And one of the good things about the Naval Academy is you get really like intimate access to all the warfare specialties over the course of your 4 years, more so than certainly ROTC. And so I was lucky enough to fly in the backseat of a Marine Corps F-4 in Kaneohe. I flew with VMFA 235, the Death Angels.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
And so the other thing that happened during my junior year, my eyes went bad. I mean, I noticed that I was looking at the board, and I'm like, I don't think I can see that well. So I went down to the flights, not the dock there, and took an eye test. And I'll never forget it. He wheeled around and he goes, well, you're not going to be flying. Oh, he basically said, you're not going to be a pilot. And that was, you know, obviously in my dad's footsteps, that's kind of was my want.
Yeah.
You know, so now it's like, okay, am I going to be a surface warfare guy? I couldn't be a nuke because I wasn't smart enough. You know, when I went to the Naval Academy, you couldn't go right into special operations. You had to be a surface warfare officer and get your SWOP in. And then maybe they'd let you be a SEAL. It's not how it is now. Okay. And, you know, I didn't want to be a grunt. So this Marine option cruise that I took, we took amphibs from San Diego to Pearl and then got off and went across Oahu to Kaneohe and spent a month, 2 weeks with the ground guys, including recon, and then 2 weeks with the aviation side, one with an H-46 squadron, 1 week with an H-46 squadron, and 1 week with the F-4 squadron. So by the end of that, I was super psyched on not just naval flight officer, but also Rio. And I was like, I seriously and ironically, you know, flying with a Marine Corps fighter squadron, and they were getting rid of the F-4. So, you know, Rios were going away in the Marine Corps. And so it convinced me that I wanted to be a Tomcat Rio. And so that's what I picked. I picked NFO, did pretty well in flight school down in Pensacola, which I love your city, a repeat, and hope to get down there to do some episodes at the museum before too long. Sterling's invited me down for that. And my good friend Hoser Miller lives down there as well. And you know, he's on the channel frequently. He was the LSO who kept me off the ramp, by the way, on Eisenhower in that North Atlantic operation. But in any case, really took to the aviation, you know, business in the T2. Back when I went through VT-10, the first airplane you got in was the T2 Buckeye. You know, no prop planes, just jump right into a jet and do the squirrel cage. And I love the feeling of G, which I'd been exposed to in the F-4, never got airsick and just was, you know, aero adaptable.
And that's awesome.
Kept my wits about me, sounded good on the radio, could navigate upside down and take notes. And, you know, I just took to that environment. That's sort of the intangible of being an aviator, as we know. And so thrived, you know, and when it came time to select, I was naturally going to pick the Rio pipeline. Went to VT-86 as a Rio student, and then it's just a matter of what coast you want, because the F-4s were all gone. They weren't sending guys to F-4s anymore. They yeah. still had the squadron in Japan, or two squadrons actually, 151 and 161 on Midway, but they weren't sending anybody there anymore. And so I was an East Coast kind of guy. You know, Virginia Beach sounded awesome. Sure. So I wound up going to VF-101. Again, loved the Tomcat community. And I think of my mentors, the first instructors I had at the Grim Reapers there, VF-101, and how they sort of, it's like joining a frat, you know, and
right.
how they sort of seeped us in this community. And as a Rio, you're sort of like, what are the pilots going to think of us? Are we, you know, second class, or is it going to be a team? And it was absolutely a team from the jump. And that, you know, being a type A kind of guy, that suited me. And I wanted to be the best possible Rio I could be. Again, I was loving, you know, all of the weapon systems and the co-pilot duties, calling the fight when the pilot lost sight, all of the missionaries of the F-14, and wound up being the top scope, which is the top Rio in my class. So I was the number one draft pick, as it were. And so nice. As a result of that, I went right on deployment. So I joined VF-32, the swordsman, now actually VFA-32, the swordsman on Eisenhower. They're deployed doing the Houthi war right now. Yeah. But we went aboard the Independence, CV-62, an old aircraft carrier, conventional aircraft carrier back when we had those.
That's the, I carry called on that for the very first time.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. Independence, yeah.
Small okay. flight deck, you know, yeah. dirty boat, but, you know, yeah. ran well, and it was a great air wing. We had a whole bunch of different type model series, you know, including A3s. We picked up a couple of A3s when we in-chopped
wow.
to okay. the med. And so this was, you know, first port call was Palma. First exercise was a NATO exercise. And we're doing cat and mouse with the Soviet Union, you know, Krivaks and Savremenis and flying intercepts, and went through the ditch, you know. And so for a brand new Lieutenant JG, fresh caught Lieutenant JG, I was the only Lieutenant JG in the squadron, by the way.
Okay.
You know, seeing my name on Gypsy 214, 214, you know, on the rear canopy rail.
Yeah.
Going through the ditch. We did a beacon flash against the Omanis, which was amazing. Did the Star Wars cannon there in the South Arabian Peninsula. We did not go into the Persian Gulf, because in those days you didn't do that. That wasn't until Desert Storm that aircraft carriers would actually go into the Gulf itself. But we did hang out in the North Arabian Sea off of the coast of Iran and intercepted Russian AN-22s and Iranian P-3s and escorted them as they flew by the carrier. And so we were doing the job we were supposed to do, which is alert 5 launch, intercept the bad guy and intercept them and escort them as they went over the ship. So action-packed, never a bad day. We were at sea long enough that I had a beer day, right? So that was a big deal. Two, you know, I think they were like Schlitz beers. I mean, this is old school, you know.
Beer, no expense.
Yeah, exactly. Right, and Lord knows how long they'd been. They had rust on the rim, you know, how long right. these beers had been in the hold there.
That was the kind
After
of beer where you pulled the
days.
Tab off and it came off, right?
Exactly, right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's right.
After 45 days, even that beer's got to taste good, I'm guessing.
It did. And so it's just so cool. You know, the band is playing, you know, the ship's band is playing Kiss covers on the flight deck, you know, and then Admiral Foley, because this is before there was a Fifth Fleet. This is Seventh Fleet owned you as soon as you went through the ditch. And so Admiral okay. Foley was Seventh Fleet. Located in Hawaii, he comes out to the ship. He's like, "You guys want to go to Singapore for New Year's? Like, let me think. Yeah, that'd be great, right?" So,
okay,
East Coast guys going to Singapore never happens.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, this is Mooch's first cruise, and we go to Singapore. Had 6 days in Singapore, an incredible city, you know, super great food and you know. Just clean and people are friendly. It was amazing. We had an admin there and we, you know, got big and great stuff. So that was my introduction to carrier aviation. And then we cross-decked to Kennedy, fresh out of the arts, not the new Kennedy, not CVN-79, but CV-67, mm-hmm. old Kennedy, that's, I think, still a Norfolk or a Philadelphia Naval Shipyard.
She's in Philly, yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. There's the swordsman patch. Very historic squadron. You may remember, if you saw the movie Devotion, that squadron is the Thomas Hudner a Jesse Brown squadron, where Thomas Hutter intentionally crashed his plane to attempt to rescue Jesse Brown, who was the first African-American naval aviator. Yeah. They couldn't get Jesse out of the airplane, so Jesse died. But Thomas Hutner eventually got a Medal of Honor for that action, and they made a movie out of it.
That was a fantastic, starring, fantastic story.
Glenn Powell, who I met, I went to the premiere, the red carpet thing on the East Coast, and got to talk to Glenn Powell, cool guy. And it turns out the director, J.R. Dillard, his dad, Bruce Dillard, was an A6BN. And he was the Blue Angels events coordinator in the late 80s.
No
and so
kidding.
Okay. It was Old Home Week, and I did not realize that J.R. had directed the movie. And unfortunately, it was an absolute flop at the box office. So,
which is terrible because, as you say, you know, it's a great story. And I thought
a great story. Really well done. You know, I have my thoughts of why it probably didn't do as well as it should have. But in any case, that's The Swordsman, a very rich history.
Yeah.
The Swordsman also were the squadron that, in the second Gulf of Sidra incident, shot down the MiG-23s.
Oh, out of Libya.
The, you know, I can't get a freaking tone. You know, I've broken that mission down on an episode, if people want to check it out. So I had just left the squadron the year before and watched that on CNN. I was an instructor at Pensacola and got home from VT-86, you know, a day of teaching Rio students, and it was on CNN. I was like, okay, that's Beads. That's little Tommy Foster. That's...
Yeah, you knew everybody.
Yeah. That's Munster. Awesome. And that's Leo the Rio. And Leo the Rio kind of commandeered the airplane, you know, and was shooting sparrows. And the greatest line in that whole thing is where Beads goes, "Oh, Jesus." Right? When his Rio is firing sparrows, you know, kind of against his will. You know, which is a Rio. Yeah. I'm like, you go, boy. But it's kind of funny knowing all the personalities there. Beads is a great guy. He was the XO when I left. And then he obviously fleeted up to be CO. But... anyway, that was VF-32. So we did the Kennedy cruise, and that was a uniquely med cruise, just all med. Okay. We didn't leave the med. So hit a lot of ports, you know, a lot of all the way from Haifa to Benidorm, Spain, a lot of French ports. My then girlfriend, now wife, came over, and I asked her to marry me in Nice on that deployment.
Oh, there you go.
You romantic bastard, you.
Romantic, right? Hey, I know how to do it, right? Got style. Curveball was falling off the table there. And so, you know, this was a good squadron and good times. I was liking the life. And you know, what's to hate about being in an F-14 squadron at the height of the Cold War? So this is pre-air-to-ground F-14 stuff. We're just doing air to air.
All right, Mooch. So, I gotta get a couple of questions in here to get time. Get time.
Same.
Your first squadron, your first cruise. What year was that?
That was 84-85.
1984-85. Okay. You said ditch. I know what you're talking about, and so does Repeat. But for our non-naval aviator cruisers, can you define ditch?
Yeah, the ditch is the Suez Canal. I'm sorry.
No worries. Keep going.
That's okay.
Yeah, the Suez Canal and, called ditch, right?
And did I understand you went back-to-back cruises on the Independent and then the Kennedy? You guys did back-to-back?
We had a turnaround cycle.
Was that 6 months or 18 months?
No, it wasn't quite 18 months. So, you know, the interdeployment turnaround cycle, you just sort of get a little bit of time off. They kind of take all your airplanes and give them to the other squadrons that are going on cruise. So you have, you know, you go from 12 to two working airplanes for a couple of months.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're just doing airways, nav, you know, cross countries to maintain proficiency. And then you start to slowly, like spring training, you know, it's pitchers and catchers. And then the rest of the team shows up and you go to Fallon. And that's where air wing training, air wing, you know,
start dropping heavy weapons
and you know, and you start to get busy. So we went on the second cruise in the fall of 86.
So that was post Top Gun movie.
Yeah. Top Gun came out. In fact, I got back from a workup period in May of 86, and my girlfriend or my fiance, right, is like, "You want to go see this movie Top Gun?" I'm like, I guess, because I'd heard about it when we were on that workup.
Sure.
The guys who came out to grade us, the CarGurus 4 guys had seen it. And they're like, yeah, it's pretty good. And we'd heard about it from the Top Gun guys, like Bio and Hollywood and Jaws and all the other guys, you know, Heater, all the gang from that era. It's the classic Top Gun era there.
Right.
And so, of course, I knew that it was coming out. So, you know, first night home, go to see it. And, you know, the opening credits with the steam and the taxi on the catapult. And I'm like, I seriously got to get a life. I mean, I just came from this. My first ride home, and I'm doing this.
Right.
But I loved it, right? I mean, I loved it. It is kind of a cartoon, but it's fun. And
Wait, are you telling me you don't do aileron rolls to shake your bogey? I'm just asking for a friend.
Obviously, it's you know, I've made a cottage industry out of pointing out the technical errors and the inaccuracies of Top Gun, the first one. But, you know, I've talked to Jerry Bruckheimer. I know Heater well, and I had him on the channel a few months ago talking about that era. I mean, it's part of my life, right? It's part of my DNA. Right. I was in a fighter squadron when it came out. The O Club was standing room only on Wednesdays and Fridays in Virginia Beach at Naval Air Station Oceana, as it was at Miramar, even more so.
Yeah.
So what's to not love about consciousness, right?
Right.
So
and we know that you played volleyball without a shirt on a lot.
Yes,
at the beach.
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
It was like, hey, you guys, we got to fly the jet. Stop playing the volleyball all the time.
Yeah. Two other quick questions before we move on. So you also mentioned beacon flashing. Was it the Omanis? You said.
Yeah. So that was an exercise against the Omani Air Force that took place over the southern part of the country, which was amazing. It was like, you know, for Star Wars people, it was like Tatooine. You know, it's the crevasses, and there was a Star Wars canyon. It's the different than the one in the States. It was amazing. So you dive into that thing and you know, just do the terrain following, and it was amazing. So the Omani Air Force had two types of airplanes, Hunters and Jaguars. And half of their pilots were expat Brits, mercenary British guys.
I'll be darned.
And so those guys were pretty good pilots, and they loved to go low. You'd think you were low, and they would go under you. You know, so we did really super cool dogfighting and low levels, and it was a great exercise. So we got to do that. I don't know if it exists anymore, you know, but it was a signature event back in those days.
Very cool. Okay. And then the other question I had is, what year did you graduate from the boat school?
82.
Naval Academy. 82. Okay.
Yeah. Nice.
Nice. All right. I'm trying to think. So I'm like 2 years behind you. I finished in 84. I wasn't at the Naval Academy, but I'm trying to think of friends that were in there, but we'll get to that post show maybe. But
Nasty was a year ahead of me.
Okay.
Right? And Ted Carter and Slapshot.
Okay.
Okay.
I've had some classmates on the channel, most notably Tom Page, talked about his barricade arrestment, and some other. I mean, CNO Richardson is a classmate of mine. Terry Dietz, who was on Survivor a couple of seasons, he's a Tomcat guy. He's a classmate of mine.
Okay.
So
okay. Well, in all of those, we get the question we always ask is the funniest or scariest. And when we stumped the guy, I went, okay. Did you ever grab the handle? Were you ever unlucky enough to reach for the ejection handle and even more unlucky to actually pull it?
Yeah. So no, I never ejected. Yes, I fished for it a couple of times. Sometimes you'd have a cat shot where you weren't at night, where you weren't sure that the pilot had it. And again, good front backseat coordination was good. You know, single engine cat shot in the A could be kind of sporty. And so, you know, just my pre-catch out routine was, you know, because the wipeout, you know, go to tension, and I'm doing a routine in the F-14A. So you go to military power, forward, aft, left, and I would look at the left to make sure all four spoilers came up, right, all four spoilers, and I'd look in the mirrors, left rudder, right rudder. Because if you look at a Super Hornet, those guys kind of do the coffee grinder thing. Where they're just, you know, stirring it. The Tomcat's very deliberate. Forward, aft, left, right, nose wheel steering disengaged, because you could ruin the nose wheel steering mechanism right. if you kept it engaged when you hit the rudders when you're in the shuttle.
Right.
So left rudder, right rudder. I'm ready, Mooch. Are you ready? I'm ready. And so I'd look over at the shooter, because this is back when they would be on the flight deck and not in the bubble, right? Because we're on conventional carriers that don't have bubbles. So the shooter's on the flight deck. Give me this. And he's pointing all around. Pilot salutes. He returns the salute, does another check. And then I would find the handle, right? Right before the shot.
Yeah.
And so the shot on the Indy, particularly on Cat 4, was not a linear shot. It was a cannon. And another they would dump the radar system, because the IMU would get all screwed up.
Yeah.
And you'd launch, and all of a sudden my screens were all black. Like, oh this is really going to be fun, this flight where I don't have anything, you know? So you would beg not to be on Cat 4, and eventually they got it, and they wouldn't shoot us off Cat 4. But, you know, if you've never felt a cat shot, the analogy that I use, some modern roller coasters, if you have one that starts like from a stop that goes, you know, on a linear acceleration into a loop, that mm-hmm. linear acceleration starts to replicate what a cat shot feels like. Except imagine a Tomcat at 67 to 72,000 pounds. These are weights you don't hear about these days. They're no airplane in the air wing is that heavy anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Not to mention they're using the nice, gentle emails and stuff like that now. Right. I'm sounding like an old guy yelling at clouds, you know, but in any case,
get off my damn lawn.
Yeah, exactly. I would always find the handle, but I never had occasion to pull it.
Well, that's good.
Right. As far as funny hops, and in fact, I told the story on Tomcat Tales 2, which I think is coming out, or it may be available now. But so we're doing a cross country in VF-32 aboard or in two F-14As. We're on our way to Fallon ultimately for air wing training, but we're going to stop at Miramar. And this is before Miramar was a Marine Corps air station. This is back, you know, Top Gun.
NAS Miramar, right?
Yeah. NAS Miramar, right? So that's where Top Gun was. That's where the West Coast Tomcat, they had 11 Tomcat squadrons at Miramar, and we had 11 Tomcat squadrons and a rag on either coast, right? The training squadron. So this was the salad days. This was the halcyon days of the Tomcat. So we're like East Coast, like Crips and Bloods. Because they literally never met.
Right.
And so we're like, we're going to go out there and show the flag. We're going to wear our flight suits with our, you know, the same patch you were showing there. And, you know, play crud against those guys, which is a full contact pool game without pool sticks. And, you know, do it up.
That's the best description I've ever heard of crud. Yeah, that's
actually
awesome.
That is. Yeah.
Full contact and, you know, pool.
That was a serious game, right? And so we had to play, you know, play the dice game and see who buys. And it was going to be a big night, right?
Ship's and so, crew.
Yeah. And so we stop it because the Tomcat couldn't go coast to coast, even with tanks. The A certainly couldn't. I've done it in the B coming west to east because you have the jet stream working with you instead of against you. So we stop at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma City. I guess that's not terribly far from you, Fig, right? I mean,
no.
How far is Oklahoma City from Kansas City?
Well, in a TA-4, I can tell you it takes exactly 28 minutes.
There you go. Okay. So we liked Tinker because it was easy to get gas, and they had a great cafe, right? And their legendary Tinker Burgers.
Tinker Burger, yeah.
Yeah. This was known service-wide, not just in the Navy. Okay, so
That's right.
Stop at Tinker, get gas quickly, go get a Tinker Burger. Okay, so we're all sitting down with our Tinker Burgers and the Rio in the wing airplane. So I'm flying with the CO, a guy named Vodka Gemmel, who I flew with almost exclusively. We flew 250-some sorties together when he was CO. Oh, so I'm flying with him. And in the wing is a first tour lieutenant and a department head Rio, who shall remain nameless because he's the point of this story. He's the punchline. And so he was an F-4. No, I take it back. It's even better than that. He was an RA-5 backseater, a Vigi guy, who transitioned to Tomcats for his department head tour. So he didn't have a whole lot of hours in the F-14.
Okay.
But he was the maintenance officer. And so we all sit down. Three of us have Tinker Burgers. That maintenance officer, lieutenant commander, has what he calls a Frito pie. So it's a bed of Fritos with chili on it. And we're like giving him grief. Like, we're a Tinker. You're not having a Tinker Burger?
Yeah.
Let's go, like, going to Katz's Deli and having something besides, you know, a pastrami sandwich or something, right? You know, yeah. Or going to the Rendezvous in Memphis and not having the ribs, right? It's like Tinker Burger, bro.
Burger.
And he's like, no, this is where you get a real Frito pie. And he kept saying that. It's a real Frito pie. We're like, how do you know it's a real Frito pie? Like, I just do, right? So, okay.
All right. Okay.
So eat our meals. Get back in the air, you know, put our Zoom bags, our speed jeans back on, get in the airplane, launch off. All right. So we filed at 29,000 feet on purpose because the ambient pressure in the airplane allowed you to not have to wear the mask. You wouldn't get hypoxic.
Yeah.
So it's another 2 hours between, you know, Tinker and Miramar. And so we're sitting there, you know, me and Vodka with our mask off, and I'm, you know, working the radios and doing the nav, and he's there on autopilot, 29,000 feet. And I look over, and both of them have their masks on, which is like, that's, and according to the OPNAV regulations, you should do that according to the NATOPS, right? So like, yeah. Man, hardcore, these guys are by the rules.
They're on it.
Right? They're on it. And so, you know, I'm just like, wow, that's zealots. You know, this is really amazing. And even Vodka notices, like, they don't have to do that for me just because I'm the skipper, you know? And so, you know, we get there, and the plan was, we'll, you know, take off our flight gear and leave everything around the jet and go right to the club, you know? And so we get to the transient ops, sort of the base ops, and the Wing Rio is already in civvies. And he's got like it's not even cool civvies. He's kind of like dressed like a dork. And he's got this long sleeve dress shirt with a too big collar and like corduroys on and these like loafers. And so like, hey man, what happened to the show the flag, man? Why are you in civvies? And his pilot, who is the first two lieutenants, is shaking his head like, don't go there. Don't even ask.
I think I know.
Yeah. And so long story short, the Rio had intestinal distress, right? He should have
been diplomatic.
It was a real chili, Frito chili pie.
So it's like, how do you know if it's a real chili pie? It gives you the shits.
It gives you the shits. Yeah, it was for real.
Turns out, right? So when I discovered that, of course, you're not going to give him any mercy.
No,
hell no.
Like I was bent over in tears laughing. I mean, that's just, I love a good like fart and a good, you know, scatological story, but that was like all world, right? And Randy was not liking being the butt of the joke, the Rio. And so we wound up in the ready room at Fallon awarding him a brown star, which is the award to get, right, when this happens. So if you've read Punk's War, you know that a pilot has that happen to him. The guy Fuzzy, when he takes the barricade.
Yeah.
And the guy, one of the deck crewmen, jumps on the airplane after he opens the canopy. He goes, "You're a hero, buddy." And Fuzzy says, "You might want to not want to get too close to me. I shit myself." Which I love that line. So anyway, that's the funniest among, you know, any day in a fighter squadron is full of levity, you know.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
A scariest beyond that hairy day in the North Atlantic was we almost had a midair over Morocco with an F-15 flying with a pilot that I didn't get along with that well. And he was a problem child and he was passed down to me, actually, ironically, from the Rio who had the real Frito pie, who didn't get along with him. So I was Mr. Fix-It, you know, I was like, I'll fly with anybody I can, you know, I'm like Helen Keller, you know, and so, but this guy was a real problem child. He had played semi-pro baseball, and his dad was an admiral and a former Blue Angel, or his father-in-law, I'm sorry, not his dad, his father-in-law. And so he had a real attitude. And he came with baggage from the rag. It was like, you know, this guy sometimes doesn't listen, and he had trouble at the boat the first time. So anyway, chasing that eagle uphill, and he pursues a winder shot like way beyond what he should have. He should have broken it off 10 seconds before he did. And I can see that this eagle is no longer flying. It's floating back down towards us.
Uh-huh.
Right? This guy's completely out of airspeed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he's just falling leaf coming back to us. My pilot doesn't realize it. And when he should be bunting to avoid a midair, he says, Fox 2 on the eagle. I'm like,
oh. Oh.
And so I said, push. And he did. And I literally heard the full burner nozzles of the eagle, and we had a thump as we went by. I swear to God, it couldn't have been more than 50 feet.
Oh, shit.
And so I said, knock it off, knock it off. And I was super pissed at the pilot. And so I said, this is over. We're just going back and waiting for the recovery. And we had words in the ready room. And I want to say that made things better. It did not. And so it's just one of those things as a Rio, this is what you sign up for, you know? So that was the scariest near midair. And I wouldn't have ejected because we would have been dead. You know, that the canopy would have just been obliterated.
So, it's I'm wrapping my head around that story. I was right there with you for a second when you were saying it. Is you are completely along for the ride.
Yes.
You're a cheerleader at that point.
Yeah, my stick controls the radar. It doesn't control the airplane.
Right. You can fly the airplane a little bit with your finger on the ICS button, right?
Yeah.
But talk about a helpless feeling. Of course, you had come to, well, I guess you had mastered that, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
You're a very experienced Rio at that point. But that's got to be, for somebody like Repeat and I, I'm really having a hard time picturing myself. Because even, you know, I had students do that to me when I was instructor in school. I had a set of controls.
Right. Yes, yes. So, you know, this reminds me, when you're talking, Fig, I'm reminded of when I embedded, when I was the editor of military.com, I embedded with the 101st Airborne in Paktika province in 2010 in Afghanistan. Okay. And we're doing an op, and all I have is a notebook, right? And one of the dudes looks at me, he goes, I don't know how you can be out here without a rifle. You know, and I said, well, let me tell you a story.
It ain't by choice.
You know?
Yeah.
So I said, you know, pilots are highly trained. I assume you're highly trained. So if it comes down to me being the guy that's, you know, got to defend us, something went horribly wrong, you know?
Right.
And it's Alamo time, right? And so, yeah, you put it well that I'd come to terms. And I think as a Rio, you have to, or you're not going to be a Rio very long.
Right.
You know, because as you say, in the end game, I can give airspeed calls and say things and try to stay ahead of the airplane and use him as a voice activated autopilot, you know, and
right.
Various pilots were more so and less so of that. I had one guy who wouldn't even drop the gear unless I said gear.
Okay. Oh, funny.
I mean, at some level it's like empowering, but another, I'm like, this is kind of messed up,
right?
You know? And so, but I was at peace with that. Ultimately, you know, you ask if I ever pulled the handle. I had the means to do a Martin Baker penetration if we had to, right? I could pull the handle to get us out in some circumstances. Obviously, midair ramp strike. That was my greatest fear, that you'd think you're going to have a ramp strike and you eject and the airplane lands safely.
Yeah. Oops.
That was like, that's nightmare fuel, right? So it's better to just like go up in a fireball than to do that, I think. And have this plat tape that's shared for years afterwards, you know, on my channel and places
right,
like that.
Right, right, right.
But yeah, I was helpless as a Rio, you know, in certain environments. Yeah, so you had to be okay with
that. Man. How about that, Repeat?
It's terrifying. I can only imagine. I mean, I came pretty close on a merge one time. In fact, we talked about it with Otto, and I got thumped by his wake turbulence. So I can only imagine. And then hearing the afterburner and
no,
that's terrifying.
So let's see. Were you still in F-14 squadrons when the first Gulf War kicked off? Yes. Or were you back as an instructor?
I was actually, I was the editor of Approach magazine.
No way. Jumping Jehoshaphats. What well, were those
that's
boys?
That's Naval Aviation News.
Oh, shit.
That's right. Different. Okay, because, Fig, I was also Grandpa Pettibone for 5 years.
No so, way. Yeah.
I relieved Zip Rousa and was, in fact, Grandpa Pettibone for
five years. I was, in fact, Grandpa Pettibone.
Yes, which was an honor. When you wear right? Gramps's flight jacket, you go to another place. You know, so I was honored to be asked to do that. I was proud to do it and write those columns for Naval Aviation News, not Approach. Right. And so Approach, I did a cartoon called Brown Shoes in Action Comics, which had kind of underground comics, you know, cultural impact. And in fact, in some environments, I'm known best as the guy who did Brown Shoes in Action Comics, more so than anything else I've done, which is, it does my heart good. But because I did the cartoon for them for a couple of years, they asked me to come be the editor. So I left VF-32, went to VT-86. I was only down there for a year. And then I went to the Naval Safety Center to be the editor of Approach magazine, where I was the first editor to be allowed to fly. And so I was at the Safety Center at Norfolk, but I was flying with the Aggressor Squadron VF-43 ambush at Oceana.
Nice.
And they had TF-16s, F-5Fs, TA-4s, and I also flew with VFC-12 and their TA-4s. And whoever needed somebody to bounce it at odd hours, you know, do carrier practice at 2 in the morning, any of the Tomcat squadrons. So long story short, I flew a lot as the editor of Approach.
Well, plus, that's great.
I kept my name. Yeah, there you go. I kept my name in the game. And so that tour got me to VF-143 as a super JO. And so that's a long answer for when the war kicked off, I was
back up. That's awesome.
The editor of Approach job, watched it on TV, on CNN, like all of us did who weren't underway.
Right.
And then I was a must pump through the rag to get to VF-143 on Ike because they thought that Ike was going to surge to join the war. So that got me to the Puking Dogs quickly. But then the war ended, you know, as I was in the rag, actually, the war ended and I joined the dogs and they had just gotten brand new, still had that new Tomcat smell, fresh from Grumman, F-14A pluses. Which was redesignated a year later, the F-14B. So that's basically an A with different engines, the GE F-110, which is an amazing, amazing engine.
That's the engine that didn't have any problems.
No. Right? Well, it did. It had one major problem. The burner liner, they had a burn through. And if that happened when you're an afterburner, it would basically blow the tail off the airplane. Oh. And I had a friend of mine killed, Fred Dillingham. There you go. There's the Puking Dogs. We were rag instructors after that VF-143 tour, and the burner liner had a burn through, and the tail came off at supersonic speeds. And he and the actually an A6 pilot who was doing LSO cross training in the front seat.
I got winged with the pilot you're talking
about. Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. And we heard that we had that story earlier on the show at some point. I don't remember which episode that was.
Jake. So Fred Dillingham was a super, super cool guy. And I remember the CEO who's also passed away, Chris Wietrich, came in and just said, "We just lost one," just like that. Came Jake, in the radio, "We just lost one."
Jeff Jacober, Jake. Does that name sound familiar? Pilot?
Again, I think that must be a West Coast guy.
He was an East and a West Coast guy. He was a
I never served with Jeff. Yeah.
86 or 87 Academy graduate.
Okay, well, we were in the community at the same time. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't.
That's what I thought. I got winged with him.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, we got to the Gulf, right? So this is the second time through the Suez on my first nuke boat. So now I'm on Ike.
Okay.
Remember, Ike's on cruise right now as we're speaking.
Yes.
So I'm talking about Eisenhower was already kind of an old ship, right? And this is 91, 92, right? So we go to the off the coast of Kuwait. And so we go through the Bab al-Mandeb, through the Straits of Hormuz, into the Persian Gulf proper. And so I'm kind of freaked out because my first cruise, that was the no man's land. You wouldn't go into the Gulf, right?
Right.
So now we're here and there's not much reaction time with Bandar Abbas and Bushehr and the other naval bases along the coast of Iran. And meanwhile, the country we've just been at war with is like right there. And so it's pretty close quarters. So we flew, this is pre-Operation Southern Watch. So there was no fly zone over southern Iraq that I did subsequent deployments. This was just flying over Kuwait, and Kuwait was still on fire. The oil fires had not been put out.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it was eerie because the sky was this. If you see any of those pictures of like any airplanes flying over the oil fires.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they have eagles and vipers and tomcats. And there's a cool puking dog picture that I just used for my Most Beautiful Jets episode of that was the deployment that I was talking about that we were on with these brand new F-14s. But the sky was brown, black, you know, and Kuwait is flat, 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 and the fires are burning. It looked like hell.
Oh, yeah.
And they hadn't cleaned up the wreckage from the war, and so the highway to hell still was strewn with vehicles. The bridges were still blown out. It was kind of like showing up the morning after a really wild party that you didn't go to. Right. You know, yes. You're like, this looks like this must have been pretty crazy.
Right.
The guys who were vets were like, yeah, it was awesome. Because some of the guys on Ike had cross-decked from, especially the Hornet guys. So this was also my first cruise with Hornets. And that was a whole new ball game. So we were the grass critical jets in the early days of my Navy career, right?
Right, right.
A Hornet is like a Tomcat with 6,000 less pounds. Right. Oh, and so they, all of a sudden in the mobility tack note, they're down at 1,000 and 2,000 feet. And we're like, you can wait, guys. So that took some getting used to. And so, but, you know, Legacy Hornet was a cool airplane. And we had a Marine Corps squadron with us as well. So that was a good time. Yeah. So there you go. That's a good example. That's a VF-213 airplane. You can also see in that image, they have the probe door pulled off.
Yeah.
So the other thing that this was an introduction to me was tanking from KC-135s, something I hadn't done heretofore.
Right.
And so
without a retractable drogue either, right?
It didn't have a retractable drogue, right? So what you do is you stick what we call a donkey dick at the end of an Air Force probe. So just for the unlearned who are listening, the Air Force system is... the tanker is the male. The receiving aircraft is the female. The Navy is 180 out. The tanker is the female. The receiving aircraft is the giving aircraft is the male, right? So you need a drogue, a big basket on the tanker if you're going to get gas from a Air Force tanker. And so they modify. Some of their tankers have both Air Force booms and drogue assemblies like the KC-10. But otherwise, on the KC-135s, they just stick this rubber hose with a basket on the end of it with no take-up reel.
Yeah. Right.
Right? And so you have to plug it, and then you have to fly form on what we call the knuckle, which takes some getting used to. It's called the Iron Maiden. And so people would lose a lot of probe doors because you'd hit it and miss it, and it would rip off the probe door and hopefully not FOD the right motor. But skippers started preemptively taking off the probe doors just so they didn't get bent. You know, so that image you just showed there, Fig, you can notice that 213 airplane already is missing the probe door. So anyway, that was all sporty evolution. Pilots would get used to it over time, you know, and so when you hit the basket and nighttime, you know, it was the level of game ramps up a few notches.
Right.
Doing it. But you got comfortable with, you know, flying form on the boom, and the reel would help with where the basket was. The hose would flop on the nose, which was kind of awkward. You know, when you put a bend in it and then it would flop on the nose of the Tomcat, and that's kind of where you wanted it. You know, so we got used to that. And this is all on my third deployment with my second tour. So I loved life. Habitability on a nuke boat is orders of magnitude better than a conventional carrier. You know, the water doesn't taste like gasoline, for instance. And other things like that. So those were good times. So that's a long answer for where was I during Desert Storm. Eventually I was in theater, and it was still technically Desert Storm, but it was post-hostilities Desert Storm.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. That's pretty, you know, the description you had of the KC-135 fueling operation was pretty spot on. We were forbidden to refuel off 135s because our probe was, you'd read, you know, you'd look at it funny.
The Harriers lost more probes on the 135, and after about a half a dozen or so, they went, all right, that's it. We clearly can't do this.
Yeah, it's pretty unforgiving. We break a lot of probe tips, rip off probes, rip off probe doors, especially when you first get into theater, you know.
Sure.
Because nobody would have practiced. We didn't do any 135 practice stateside. You know, it's just like, hey, welcome to the show. You get to tank off a 135 nugget guy who's having trouble landing on the boat, not to mention at nighttime. Yeah, there you go. On the left there. And then on the right is that A3 with a nice gentle take up reel, you know, and so you could be a little sloppier with that. Although you couldn't hit it off too hard because you'd create a sine wave. It would come back and rip the pro off. Right. But, you know, that is a lot more forgiving. And when you're in it, you can move around a little more than you could with the Iron Maiden.
That picture also showed it had stripes on the hose. Remember the white stripes? I forgot. Maybe they're 10 or 15 feet apart. So you could put, if you push it in so far, you had to push it in to get the fuel going, I think.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah,
I know, right?
Right? Definitely not in the very moment. That was always a white knuckle evolution.
Right? And especially at night, I can only imagine. Holy
shit.
Yeah,
you have the glow, this little red glow of your, when your refueling probe came out, there was a little red light in there that would illuminate the basket.
Sure. Sure. So you talked earlier about escorting the bad guys. Did you ever have any times when you thought the bad guys were going to be more hostile than just wandering across the carrier group? Or
no, they were all pretty docile. You know, it's like we were like remoras on a whale shark kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was just fun that you had a your adversary, especially when it was a Soviet airplane.
Sure.
You know, and the AN-22. Which is NATO code name, I'm not making this up, COCK is the NATO code name of the AN-22. It's very Jules Verne looking, steampunk. You know, it's got these droopy wings and four propellers. It's gigantic. Yeah. And so we pulled up close, and the Rio had a little fix. This is pre, like you've already said, Fig, you know, pre-cell phone days. So we had a Brownie. It was a Nikon that had a fixed lens. You couldn't move it. And so the Rio's responsibility was to take a whole bunch of pictures and then take them back to the Intel Center, and they would, you know, wet film, produce the film or develop the pictures. There you go. That's the first intercept I ever did in the North Arabian Sea was against one of those.
Yeah. That was actually the largest airplane before the C-5. That was the largest airplane in the world. Okay. Yeah. And the only reason I know that is I shot some great film out of there. Out of Almaty, Kazakhstan, one day those guys took off right in front of us, big four engines, counter rotating props, and it was 12,000 foot runway, and I bet he took 11,800 feet to get off.
So they're cruising around at 200 knots or whatever, and so they were coming from Karachi, going to somewhere on the east coast of Africa, Djibouti, I think, and so you know we would launch on the alert. And this was fantastic conditions for the F-14 and the AUG-9 radar. Over water, so there's no ground return, you know, and gorgeous day. So I had like 150-mile contact on this guy, you know. And we're getting the E-2 giving us the vectors. And so we join on him, taking pictures. And so we got close enough that we could see the dudes in those little windows,
And
they had like those leather football helmets on, their flying helmets that they use.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? And so we would, for these very occasions, bring Playboy magazine.
Right on.
You know? And, centerfold. And so centerfold, you know, and they're like, thumbs up, love you, no lie, right? And then the coup de grace was, and we were low enough that we could take, you know, turn off the cabin pressure because it was very loud when you did this. So you'd stop of the air source and take the helmets off, and we both had Ronald Reagan masks. And we look over like, you know, hello, right? And they got a real kick out of that. They got an absolute kick out of that. So it's kind of like this brotherhood of the air, right? It's like, you know, hey, if you do something stupid, yes, we will blast you out of the sky. But since we're, you know, being cool, let's be brothers of the air, you know? And so that was really fun. And you know, I did some other events with the Russians, most notably the first cruise of Kuznetsov that I document on the channel when I talk about the carrier Kuznetsov, that felt the same kind of way.
Okay.
But that started very early in my career with this sort of you know, across the different nations, the sort of kinship thing. And that was right. really cool. So that was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, you don't hear stories like that really, unless you're listening to somebody like you, or, you know, the AF-14 guys that did all.
Well, the world has changed so much, you know, and I got nothing on the guys on Ike right now. I mean, every day is an adventure. You know, you're going to fire AMRAAM and Winder. It's just a matter of what. Right. You know, it's like doing, you know, Comp 2X every day off the coast of Puerto
right.
Rico.
Right.
You know, firing Hellfires at Houthi boats and SM2s off of every Arleigh Burke. I mean, those guys, you know, props to the Black Shoes, right? But yes, the first deployment of Kuznetsov, that ship right there.
There it is, yeah.
Happened when I was a department head in VF-102, the Diamondbacks, again, a B squadron, and flying off of, it was the last deployment of the USS America, not the amphib that we have now, but the carrier CV-66 America. And the Kuznetsov entered the Med and proceeded to break, and it was anchored off the coast of Tunisia. They couldn't even make water.
Oh, geez.
And so they were ferrying water from Tunisia to the ship just so they could have water. But they weren't doing any flight ops. They had one navalized SU-27 on the flight deck and some of their, you know, their cool helicopters. And so we brought the admiral of the fleet and their air wing commander and the ship CEO and some other dignitaries from Kuznetsov in our helicopters, H-60s, over to America. And we were in the Ionian. So we proceeded to launch 50 jets in rapid succession off one of the oldest aircraft carriers that we had.
Why they were on board.
It set Russian carrier aviation back, I got to guess, 20 or 30 years. You know, are we doing? Why did we even try this? You know, it was the greatest. And the battle group commander was a guy named Bill Cross. Hulk was his call sign. And he was a Tomcat guy. Very type A American. So it was a very obnoxious American show of what we can do for our our Russian guests. It's like, watch this. You're broke off the coast of Tunisia with one airplane. Here goes 50 airplanes.
Yeah.
And we flew in the back one of our airplanes, the chief test pilot for MiG. And he came back, and this was a quote that we put on the back cover of our end of cruise report. To fly with the Diamondbacks is the greatest day of my life. You know, he didn't have a stick in his cockpit, right? He's in the back of a Tomcat, and he loved it. So, in fact, I have a picture. If you go to my Instagram page, there's a picture of me with Ted Templeton landing on America with a Sovremeny off the port side of America. It's a beautiful image, and if you. Wait a second.
Awesome. I think Styx is working on that now.
Okay. Yeah, just go scroll down on my Instagram page and you'll find it towards the bottom.
Okay.
And so, you know, these are the times where, you know, I was lucky enough to serve in, particularly in F-14, between eras, right? So it started with WW Cold War, the F-14 doing what it was intended, and it ended with the F-14 being a precision bomber.
Yeah, how about that?
Fighting asymmetric threats, right? And so the introduction of the Lantern Pod. Well, first we started off with dumb bombing, you know. So suddenly the stuff we judged you light attack guys about, you know, or the attack mafia about, you know, it's like, oh, that's inelegant, that bomb dropping. All of a sudden we're doing it. Yeah. You're like, hey, can you tell me about JMEMs again? How does that work? And, you know, fusing, you know, and all that. And so yeah.
What's the harp angle again?
And yeah, exactly. And pop up and loft and you know. All the stuff that you guys knew by heart, you know, CIP and all of that, we had to figure out that symbology and the switchology in the rear cockpit. And we started with dumb bombing. And then when the late, great Snort Snodgrass, who's a good friend of mine, was fighter wing, he and Larry Slade, who had been a POW in Vietnam, in Desert Storm, great Tomcat right. Rio, fast-tracked the Lantern Pod, just the targeting pod, not the navigation pod, and stuck it on the Tomcat. And that changed everything in terms of the F-14's utility. And so suddenly the Rio is super busy because I have another stick and I'm the guy who guides where the pod goes and my scope is different.
The Rio became the CISO.
Yes, exactly.
Right? I mean,
Rizzo, you know, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's Snort. And that's that legendary picture of him flying on America, actually. That's on America. He's not as close as that picture makes you think he is.
Well, that's a big airplane. So
it
could be a couple miles away that airplane's so big.
Deck, yeah. On the flight deck with his hands behind his back there
yes.
is Jay Johnson, who's later the chief of naval operations, Tomcat guy. He was the air wing CAG. So this was sanctioned. There's all these rumors about how he did it, and he wasn't. That was not. He didn't almost lose his wings. It's just a badass picture. And Snort pulled a great picture. One. So we, you know,
yeah. For the listeners, it's the Tomcat with the right wing below the carrier deck, flying doing a knife edge pass, basically flyby. It's just
if you Google gorgeous. Snort Snodgrass, that picture comes up.
Yeah,
right. So, yeah, I think to Fig's point, my stories are a function of the time I served. Right. I mean, it was just this amazing life I was allowed to live for 20 years. And now this is the beauty of the YouTube channel is I can retell these stories to a pretty massive audience, just like you guys do. And, you know, reawaken my call sign, you know, Mooch.
Right.
I'm like Ben Kenobi. You know, I mean, nobody called me Obi-Wan for years until we start to bring it back on the channel. And now I'll be out in public and people are like, "Hey, Mooch, I love your channel." I'm like, "Yeah, thanks, bro."
Hey, right. Yeah. Right.
So, yeah. It's well, how many of your buds do you not know their first name?
Yeah. Well, you know, that was always a funny thing. You'd come home and the wives would call their spouses, their husbands by their name.
Well, Tommy and like, Jerry and who?
Yeah, you're like, you go, Fuji? Who the hell is that?
Fuji? You know, his real name's Tom.
Yeah.
Like, that's your name?
Right.
You know, you had no idea, right?
No. Why would you?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was a name associated. You're like Bono or Cher, right? It's just you're a single thing.
Yeah.
So Mooch means so much. And especially when I was in uniform, you know, it was my identity. It was my, you know, being a known guy within the community that I took great pride in performing and being part of a great bunch of aviators with a very important mission was a gift, right?
I mean, right. You know. Now, did you hit the fleet with a really cool call sign that you assigned yourself, how did that work?
I wasn't
nothing.
That
okay.
stupid. No. And so my first, like, meta call sign was Stork.
Okay.
You know, and so because the then XO, who I flew with a bunch that I was talking about in that one sea story, he was a huge Animal House fan. And so I'm tall.
Okay.
Yeah.
And kind of dorky.
Yeah.
So he would call me Stork. Stork's a dork.
Doesn't right? tall name Stork.
Yeah. Stork's brain damage. And so that became my call sign until shortly when we pulled into port, into Palma. And, you know, I was a must pump first round draft pick, ill prepared for deployment, right? Just a young
but you were earning all them big bucks as a JG.
Right, exactly. Right, so you'd be in port, and it's like you're around. I'm like,
I got it.
Finally, Fuji Lansdale was like, "You're a Mooch," and you know, it's just one of those moments that it just forges.
That's
you
it.
You realize you can almost hear it, like frozen in time. You're a Mooch, and it just instantly matched its call sign. So no more Stork, Mooch for that forevermore thereafter.
Nice. That's
well, it rolls off the tongue much easier.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I got used to it. I'm not, I earned it, right?
Right.
I wasn't Mooch.
It's the guys who fight it.
Oh,
that's
well,
always
that's the worst.
Yeah. Blood in the water.
There was a guy that in the sister squadron, VF-14, his call sign was Worm, right?
Oh, this is good.
Because he was sickly skinny, and they're like, "You must have worms," right?
Love
and
it.
So He in the ready room said, "I didn't spend all this time doing well in flight school to get the call sign Worm." Oh really? Well, guess what? Now it's entirely.
Yeah.
If there was any debate, it's over.
Oh yeah.
If you had another guest.
Yeah. Yes. So it's like stupid things to say if you don't want that to be your call sign.
Yeah. Right. Perfect. Well played, sir. Yeah. Way to go, asshole.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Oh, Mooch, how many years did you serve in the Navy?
Exactly 20 and change. So I finished up teaching at the Naval Academy. So the Navy was very good to me year 0 through 16, I did nothing but fly pretty much. And even when I wasn't in flying jobs, I did fly. So as I said, I was the editor of Approach, flew with the Aggressor Squadron. I was aide to Air Lant and flew with Air Lant, who was Tony Less. He's CEO of the Blues and amazing stick. So we flew everywhere, mostly in F-14s. So he was an A-7 guy, and I went into RAG instructor mode when it came to wing sweep and stuff, because sometimes you get a little confused with where's the spider detent. And we'd be at that altitude in the wing. The airplane would start bucking because the wings were too far forward in manual.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, hit master reset, grab the handle, move it aft until you feel a clunk, you know, and that kind of thing. I love Admiral Less. See him occasionally still to this day. But even in that job, I flew. So
that's outstanding.
I did back-to-back sea duty. I was a department head in VF-102. That cruise where we did Kuznetsov. Did the Bosnian War, that deployment. We were in the Adriatic a bunch, flying our asses off. Amazing squadron and all-star team on one of the oldest aircraft carriers that was performing amazingly. You know, that just shows you the resilience of the machine that is carrier aviation. And then the guy who was the deputy CAG, Boomer Stelfelbeam, went on to be an admiral, asked me if I would like to be his air wing operations officer. And I love Boomer, cool guy, surfer, athlete, actually played for the Detroit Lions before he started flight school, when he finished the academy, before he started flight school. And so I said, yes. And I called the wife on the sailor phone home, you know, thing. I'm like, do you mind if we take it around the track again? And she was a great Navy wife. She's like, sure. We like it better when you're not here anyway. You know, so it worked out great. So I did the air wing ops job. We went from America to George Washington. And I'd also done the shakedown of GW when I was in the dogs. We did a 6-weeker on GW when it was a brand new carrier. But now it's a full up, you know, deploying asset. So we used to call them battle group commanders. They're now called strike group commanders. Was a man you may have heard of named Mike Mullen. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, right?
Yep.
So an amazing human being. I remain very close to him. He lives here in Annapolis, and we play golf a lot together. I've had him on the channel. Longest episode in the history of my channel, 2.5 hours. If you haven't watched it, I highly recommend it. It is an oral history of great import. But Admiral Mullen comes walking into my office. I'm in CAG Ops. We're running Southern Watch, the no-fly zone, and I have a phone to each ear. And I'm like, sir? He's like, what are you doing for follow-on orders? And I hadn't really talked to my detailer yet. I had made 05. And so he was thinking, okay, well, maybe send you back for a quickie and then you'll come back to ship's company. I'm like, I did back-to-back sea duty. All I've done is go to sea. I don't even know my younger son. You know, give me a break. He's like, hey, sorry, man, we need you. And so I told that to Admiral Mullen. He's like, okay, let me see what's up. And so he comes back and he's like, well, what, you want to teach at the Naval Academy? I'm like, don't I need like a PhD or something? I mean, all I have is a bachelor's degree from the Naval Academy. He's like, no, they have this job that they've been hiding. Another Tomcat Rio named Mark Clementi was sitting on the, what we call the billet code. And so they'll free it up for you. So do you want to teach at the Naval Academy? I'm like, are you kidding me? Yes, that'd be great.
Right?
So I had one more look at command screen. And so if that had happened, I wouldn't have been at the Naval Academy very long. And so, you know, very competitive community. And my first tour on paper wasn't that awesome in terms of, you know, fit reps. Admittedly, that's where the idea of Punk's War came from, by the way. And so that atmospheric is captured in my debut novel. If you haven't read it, or if you have read it, you get it. But so long story short, I wound up going to the Naval Academy to teach. And we lived on the Academy grounds. And I was the officer rep for the dinghy team, which was my sport when I was there. And my coach was the coach. He'd come back 17 years later. And so it was magic. And then I also started their flying program, their competition flying program. And the superintendent was a P3 guy who bought us two Cessna 172 SPs. And we had unlimited gas. And some of the mids were, you know, flight instructors. And it was amazing. So I taught those guys how to do breakup and rendezvous and act like a squadron. Happy to say that of them got jets that year that went aviation. They all got jet grades. And one of them, Jay Consalvi, is in the movie Speed and Angels. If you've seen Paco's movie Speed and Angels.
Okay.
Yeah. Jay is one of the mids that was on the flying team. So it was a very cool, again, I have Admiral Mullen to thank for putting his finger on the scale for those orders, because they weren't in my scan, you know. And I finished Punk's War during that tour. Because if you're an academic, it's not like fraud, waste, and abuse to be working on a novel. You know, if you're in a ready room, it's like, why aren't you rewriting a tack note or something? What are you doing writing a novel?
Right.
Right. It's not very cool in a fighter squadron. But if you're, you know, in, like, I was an adjunct in the English department, and they come into my office, like, what are you working on? I'm like, well, my novel. They're like, fantastic. Can I read the manuscript? Right. And so it really was conducive to me finishing the book, which I did. And Naval Institute Press wound up publishing it a year later. And the rest is sort of my post-Navy life. Yeah, there's Jay right there. That's him on the cover of the Speed and Angels DVD.
Okay.
A cool movie, by the way, because Megan is the female aviator. I knew her as a mid as well, and she's an awesome human being. And Paco is a cool guy, too. So, again, all these people, I've had them on the channel in various forms, and this is the beauty of what I'm allowed to do now on YouTube, which is really another gift.
Oh, very cool. So, yeah, and we'll mention it again near at the end, but so you've written the trilogy. It's the Punk's trilogy, Punk's War, Punk's Wing, and Punk's Fight?
Yep.
Okay.
That's the body of work I'm proud of.
Okay.
They hold up. That was, you know, I think everybody, if they take the time and have the fight with themselves, which is the way I write, they have a book in them. I had three in me. And so I'm proud. Those books hold up. Obviously, they're still selling 22 years later and 23 years later.
Yes,
the other fast. Two are forgettable. I mean, The Aid is kind of a fun book. Militia Kill is a piece of junk. You know, it's terrible. It's a terrible book. That's what happens. If all those movies you've seen of a guy having writer's block and you know, all the emotional turmoil. Because when you're writing a novel, you have to live with the world you've created. You've got to live in it.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So I'd wake up and I'm like, I got to hang out with these assholes all day long that I don't like. Right. And so I went to my agent, who's still my agent, a guy named Ethan Ellenberg up in New York. And I said, Ethan, I don't think I can finish this book. He's like, okay, then turn in the advance. I'm like, you know, funny thing about the advance, it's already spent, you know? And so I thought it was like J.K. Rowling, where I could like slide the deadline like a year out and they wouldn't care. They're like, no, you're not J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
So I delivered it, but it's not awesome. So I love the Punk's trilogy, and I'm glad, like I said at the outset, I'm very happy that the YouTube channel has created a don't buy that book.
It's, right, you don't hear that very often.
The first half is okay. Yeah. The first half is okay. The second half is a bad, you know, Pulp Fiction.
If only you'd have had an infinite number of monkeys on an infinite number of typewriters to finish it for you, right?
Bob
you
Newhart, know, right? Yeah, that's a great Bob Newhart sketch. Yeah, the first three, I put my heart and soul into them, you know, and each has a different personality, and I love them each for different reasons. I think the one that could be most easily made into a movie is Punk's Fight. And we've tried. It's been optioned a few times. My man, Arnie Schmidt, who's a real IMDb kind of guy, has tried. We took a meeting with DreamWorks that ultimately resulted in nothing. So as hard as it is to get a book published, it's like a million times harder to get a movie made of your book.
Oh, I can only imagine.
So I'm happy to have like had the opportunity and had it optioned a few times and seen that process. Because people are always like, why don't you make it into a movie? I'm like, I have PTS on trying to get it made into a movie. But but anyway, yeah, so that all happened. Punk's War was finished while I was at the Academy, and that informed what I was able to do in my post-Navy life,
nice.
Which is be in the digital media space, which kept me in touch with the military, and I became less parochial when I was dealing with all services and all warfare specialties within all services. Like I said, I embedded with the 101st Airborne in Paktika province, and also went down south to Bastion and hung out with, you know, and went to Kandahar with the International Coalition and interviewed McChrystal right before he got fired in 2010. And
that's when you were the editor of military.com? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Which remains the biggest military website on the planet. And so I was in pre-social media. So the idea of a website, you'd obsess about your homepage layout. Now nobody cares. But in those days, you know, everything mattered a lot. And heat mapping and, you know, all of the HTML and CSS. And I learned how to do all of that. The founder of military.com is a naval aviator named Chris Michael, who's an entrepreneurial genius. who brought me aboard. I was unqualified for the job, and he gave me some tough love for the first year there. It's like working for Steven Jobs. And my learning curve as a result of that tough love was steep. And so I was there at military.com for 9 years, got poached to go leave San Francisco and go to Hollywood. Okay. And became the editor-in-chief of WeAreTheMighty.com, which is founded by two MTV execs. And Paul Zoldra, who's the founder of Duffel Blog, and he was the editor-in-chief of Task and Purpose. He was my executive editor. We lived together in Hollywood, which was crazy. The office was literally under the Hollywood sign out there.
Nice.
So that was a cool introduction to that world. I mean, we grew We're the Mighty very quickly and left that to help a friend who I wound up firing here in Annapolis with her spouse website that got acquired by Task and Purpose, by Zach at Task and Purpose. And I like Zach, but I didn't want to work for Zach. So I wound up going to the Naval Institute, who published Naval Punks War originally, and worked there for 5 years on their a bunch of stuff, including their media space. We founded with Bill Hamlet the Proceedings podcast, which remains there. And in the meantime, I started the YouTube channel as a proof of concept to grow the Naval Institute's YouTube channel.
Right.
And it had the audacity of exploding and taking over my life.
Yeah.
And so I quit the Naval Institute 2 years ago to pursue the YouTube channel full time.
Nice.
Outstanding.
And a fun channel it is. I'm telling you, folks, go watch Ward Carroll's YouTube channel. It is, the content on there is amazing. I first actually ran across you when you did the, don't get old, it's bad for your memory, the deconstruction of
the Kara Holmgren's
channel. Yeah, everybody. Yeah. I went through primary first... with Kara. So.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. I had done Hawk missiles before I went to flight school, and we went through primary together. And sweet gal, so really liked her, but she got put in where she didn't.
No, it was yeah. So I've come at that a number of different ways.
Yeah.
I know a whole bunch of guys who were in 213 at that time, and yeah, it was an unfortunate circumstance.
Yeah,
but that was my first episode to go over 1 million views. It's nibbling at 4 million now.
Yeah, that's
it's a perennial performer, and I think it's because I just kind of antiseptically dissect.
Yeah, here are the facts.
And it
came out really well.
I think people appreciate that. Yeah. I don't.
I'll tell you what, that
women can't fly route.
That squadron had a black cloud hanging over it for a while.
It did.
I mean, they were
losing. That was a bad era. Well, oh, I've done another episode about the guy who crashed in Nashville. That was another 213 mishap. And that's a lesson in the backseat to front seat program. He was a retread.
Okay.
That was the same era. You know, that happened. Those things happened kind of in rapid succession. So that was a bad time.
Mm. Mm.
All right.
We're getting near the end, but I'd actually like to take just a minute or two to ask you about, I noticed there's one, two, there's three, there's four and a mini guitars behind you.
Yeah. I'm missing a guitar right now. I have an SG as well.
Four.
But
okay.
Just in, so that's a,
yeah.
A Gibson Les Paul standard.
Okay.
Right?
Nice.
A Marshall JCM 800 rig, the Studio 20. So it's a 2x20 cabinet, 20 watt amp. I love this amp. It's incredible. That's just a standard of Fender mandolin. I can only play one song on mandolin. Losing My Religion is the only song I can play on mandolin.
Nice.
All right.
And that's a mini acoustic that we bought in Tennessee just because it looked cute.
Okay.
It does play. And then I have a Gibson SG that's being tweaked at my luthier just a mile away. So it's not here. It's a red Heritage 61 that I love. And then the last guitar is this Les Paul Junior, which is a bratty P90 pickup. One pickup, two knobs. It's great. So I'm in a band called Danger Boy.
Right.
And we gig around Annapolis. I've been in bands since I was in sixth grade, including the whole time I was at the Naval Academy. I was in various midshipman bands and all those fighter squadrons. We had bands. I had a band down in Southern Maryland called Miles from Clever for 20 years. It was a very popular group down there.
Nice.
We broke up a few months ago because the drummer is going through a divorce and he sold his house and he moved away. And his house is really practiced down in the county south of me.
So that was women.
Yeah. That's a long story, but
don't rate me, gals. I'm kidding.
So as we're driving back from the show where he announced that he was getting a divorce, the bass guitarist who lives up here by me said, "There's a drummer in up in the Annapolis area who's fantastic." He was actually Charlie Watts' drum tech for a while, and he could ask him if he was interested. So we went from a four piece to a three piece, which I'm now without Annette, and there's no, I can't fake it like I was in the other band. So when I'm not doing YouTube episodes or playing golf, I'm practicing. You know, I have our set list like right here. You know,
oh geez,
right? And I've never been more challenged. We're playing stuff that's it's a cover band, but it's you know, challenging. It's not just like Sweet Home Alabama. We're playing like some real technically challenging stuff. But we're having a blast.
You've gotten to sit in, though, with some fairly famous people over the
I have. I've sat in, well, most notably Cheap Trick.
Okay.
I got to sit in with Cheap Trick. They headlined the Tomcat Farewell event back in 06, and so I played Surrender with them, and I'm still in touch with Rick Nielsen, who's a fantastic guy. So I've met a lot of my heroes, both golfers and rock musicians, and I've never been disappointed.
I used
being in the Navy as a vehicle to do that, and now I use the YouTube channel for the same you know, utility.
Well, that's awesome. Wow.
Yeah, so much fun. Wow, awesome. Well, we've taken a bunch of your time this afternoon, so I think it's probably time that we begin to land the airplane. That's easy for me to
land
say.
It.
Yeah.
All right, you guys got to do it. I'll right? just do this.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
Your arms will get tired.
Look at the landing check. I'll listen.
On the rails. Well,
we're going to need your guidance, I'm sure. Any good pilot would take it. So, oh, there you go.
Well, I'll give it, even if you're not going to take it.
Right. You go. Well, first of all, thank you for your service. Absolutely appreciate your service
in
all the forms that it's taken over the years. But folks, go out and get Punk's Trilogy, Punk's War, and Punk's Wing. I'm sorry. Punk's War, Punk's Wing, and Punk's Fight is the Punk's Trilogy, available on Amazon.com. The aid is also good. Do not buy Militia Kill.
No, don't.
Never heard an author say, don't buy their book. That's awesome.
Aftermarket system anymore. Right? Let's get rid of those.
Yeah, but available on Amazon.com. In addition to thanking you, obviously, thank all the veterans. Thank all the active duty military. Mm-hmm. And the families who go through so much sacrifice. And I will say that, take a personal moment here, that I attended day before yesterday a remembrance. I did not go to the funeral for a gent by the name of Jack Casey, Marine CH-53 pilot who lost his life about a week and a half ago out just east of San Diego. He was from Dover, New Hampshire, about 2 or 3 miles north of where I live, graduated from the same high school as my daughter, and young Marine captain gave his life in the line of duty along with 5 other Marines. So those families are all sacrificing, and they've sacrificed a lot for this country. And our gratitude goes out to them, and words can never begin to express that, that gratitude.
Well said.
Yeah,
so. Yeah.
Well said. Well said, sir. We need to say thanks to Dave Hamilton.
Absolutely.
Right? Dave Hamilton, Matt Geek Gab for making all this happen for us. The Gig Gab, the Business Marine, what else has he got going on over there?
Well, he's the man behind BackbeatMedia.com who handles all of our advertising and got us the bandwidth, courtesy of CashFly. So if you wanted to write to us.
Fig, sothereiwas.us, repeat at sothereiwas.us. If you really want a good answer. It sticks. And so there I was, right. .us, because Sticks is in the background. I can see him over there. He's actually the brains behind the operation. Him and Bago.
He's making it all happen. He's actually the gent who managed to reach out to Mooch on our behalf and bring him in for us. So thank you.
Indeed, well Sticks, done, sir.
And you and Bago both. So, yeah. If you want to get some of the cool merch that we have out there, go to sothereiwas.us/merch and get yourself a bikini. Summer's coming up. Right?
Mooch, I rock the bikini. You should see it.
Close your eyes. Plug your ears, Mooch. You don't want to hear this. You don't want an image you can't get rid of.
You will never get that vision out of your mind. I wouldn't do that to you, sir. Not at all.
Oh, man. And then let's see. Help us out.
Yeah, rate us. Give us a rating. If you're not giving us a 5-star rating, tell us why not, and we'll fix it because we're trainable. I mean, look at us. We're morons, right. But we're trainable.
Crayon-eating, window-licking brains.
Although I'm a little concerned, Mooch, when you said you flew with one pilot that wouldn't put the gear down until you told him to put the gear down. I'm still scratching my head on that. I'm thinking that's just something.
It is. Well, that was, yeah. Eventually, he became more autonomous, but there was a point when I realized that he's too much voice activated autopilot. But that was the exception.
Too funny. Yeah. A little bit of the music you're hearing in the background, none other than the Dos Gringos. Two of them, not one, but Dos. Get their music on Amazon, Spotify, Pandora, Apple Music, and more. Fun music. They were guests on the show. Great guests. Very clever and talented musicians. Mooch, you ever gotten to sit in with the Dos Gringos?
I have not, but I'm a fan. Those guys are great.
F-16 guys that make the Air Force sound good, and that's hard.
Yeah. No, I'm familiar.
They
good
do
stuff.
Indeed.
Love it.
Yeah. So,
see, we got to say thanks to a couple donors.
Yes.
Rich.
Dog Walker.
Dog. Call sign Dog. The great Tuntini. Thank you, sir. And Bud Spencer. Call sign. Did you have a call sign for Bud?
I don't. You got one? Billy Bud?
Well, Bud Spencer is the call sign for another Navy guy named Charles Spencer. Yeah. So I don't, it's really freaking me out.
Well, he's George, so that's kind of his call sign. But
Bud? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so there you go. Thank you, Bud. Yeah.
Donated $100 straight to us. Dog gave us $25. Tintini gave us $50.
Steve Morovitz?
Yeah.
Section lead.
New section lead. Yeah.
More of it's more of what's.
More of what? More of this,
thank
more
you,
of that.
Steve.
More, indeed.
Thank you, sir.
Hey. Great guest this week. So much fun.
Wow.
Sir,
thank
if
you, Mooch.
Mooch, if you can come up with more stories, love to have you back. Absolutely had a ball, and I'm sorry
that
we're having to let this go. It went way too fast. So
it went
no,
way
my
too
pleasure,
fast.
Guys. Thanks for the invite. I had a blast as well.
Come back and talk some more ACM.
Look forward to talking to you guys, and hopefully we can see each other in real life before too long.
That sounds like a plan. So, until next week, everybody, stay safe and check six.
Well, there I was, crossing the pond, and you could see that I wasn't exactly fond of all the shit I was wearing on that day. Now an F-16 is cramped enough, but it's even worse with all that stuff supposed to save your life. But we knew there was no way. Cause when you're going down the North Atlantic, man, it's over.
Hold on, it's what?
He said it's over.
Fucking out and going home.
And we're out.